This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we're going drinking, carousing, merrymaking for the most part, and music making with the Norwegian violinist Bjarte Eike and his group Baroque Solistin. This ensemble, formed in 2005 in Norway, is made up of classically trained musicians with deep interest in period instrument performance, dance, theater, song. All the members bring a mixed palette of talents to bring this off, and they are touring the U.S. with their latest project and CD called Alehouse Sessions. They bring this carousing night of music and fun to Princeton as part of the Princeton University Concerts next week. I'll give details at the end of our chat. This project has been released on CD on the newish British label called Rubicon Classics. We're listening to the track titled Curtain Tune, taken from Henry Purcell's music for Timon of Athens. As the Alehouse Sessions draws music from the English public houses of the turbulent 17th century, when music went underground under Cromwell and the Pietists, into these establishments, re-emerging in the light of the Restoration, all the time mixing popular music of the day with music by accomplished composers who took part in the music-making at pubs or alehouses, and now all brought vividly to life by my guest and his band. I spoke with Bjarte Eike by phone from Norway last week. Happy to be speaking today with Bjarte Eike, who is the founder also and head of Baroque Solistin. And first of all, congratulations on the recording and the success of the Alehouse Sessions. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm not sure if you saw it to be quite so successful when you thought it up, but it really has become that way.
You can't anticipate those kind of things, whether you just want to do a project because it's been cooking for a while.
You're right.
And we've been doing live versions of it for about 10 years. So it was sort of ripe for making a recording of it. So I'm just happy that it comes through.
Well, we're going to talk about the music and everything else, but you're going to be doing here stateside. You're going to be doing performances in Princeton, but New York, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Chicago, St. Paul. So just to give our audience a flavor, is it safe to say that if someone were to follow your group around and catch every single one of those performances, that there would be some difference in each one? And if so, explain the dynamic of the difference, how it comes out night to night.
Well, I will definitely guarantee that there will be differences, and some bigger than others.
Right.
But we work in a way that I try to keep this as a very much a live project. So it's not a fixed show as such. We have the backdrop of the Baroque time and all the stories, which I'm sure we're going to talk about.
Right.
And the music that's from there, but I've sort of expanded it also. It's more important that it is about the group and the collective great feeling we have amongst each other, both off and on stage. And we've developed a sort of a way of working, which is founded a lot on improvisation, on trust in each other's. Everybody has their specialities, one could say. All of us are quite extrovert people on stage.
Yeah.
So it's trying to find the balance between the collectiveness and the individual stars that they are, my colleagues and friends. So in order to keep it alive, we have during the years built up a rather large repertoire. And if we would play everything, we would, you know, play for about 5 or 6 hours for sure. Right. And I like to include quite a lot of improvisation. So that means that some of the stretches in one night might become quite a bit longer than if we do the same set the second night. So it depends on the inspiration we have. And then we look at the venue, we arrive, we try out the acoustics a bit. And then a typical night would be we would meet maybe half an hour before the show, and I have a set list of the night. So we just talk through what we're going to start with and the order of things. And then I even might change it on stage. And I write down all my set lists so I know. So when we get re-invitations to festivals, I make sure that we don't play the same.
I want to talk about the musicians in the group, but first of all, just stick with the live performance. How does, or does, I should rephrase the question, does the audience affect how the program progresses? How do you play off of the audience?
Well, it's a type of program which is very much dependent on the audience in the way that if they respond, I mean, I have to say, I mean, in all honesty, we have been very lucky that we have had very responsive audiences around Europe up to now. Some places, like when we play in England, for instance, we did the Shakespeare's Globe Theatre, they have a tradition there to, you know, to banter the people back and shout things, and so it becomes a very much a two-way communication, and that definitely affects us. That makes us want to do even more and challenge them even more, and they understand all the jokes and all the texts, obviously, which I think also the Americans will do. And in Germany, they are a bit more polite, which I just came home from, or I just came to Norway from a tour in Germany. We did our last show last night in Hamburg, and we did 4 shows. They were all very different, different types of audiences. So if we are in a hall where people are a bit more conservative, say we played in Vienna in a concert house, and then you know that they are a bit more conservative and they are used to top-notch classical musicians every weekend or every day almost, then you might ease into the whole thing a little bit more, maybe start a bit more, you know, proper, and then slowly work it in. And usually we do get them, though. So they tend to all like to join in singing and participate. And I have certain things up my sleeve to to make them participate whether they want to or not.
So. Yeah, the Vienna Concert House is a long way from a London pub down under, but I guess you got to drag them into that New Year's Eve mode that they love to get into.
Yes, exactly.
And it's a good thing the Globe Theater audience stops at just shouting back at you, because they used to throw stuff at people too.
In the day,
you know.
Yeah, I know.
Back to the recording of the Alehouse Sessions by my guest Bjarte Eike and his Baroque Solistine. Here is the opening track on this CD snapshot of this fun, fascinating project. This from John Playford's The English Dancing Master, and it's called Walham Green. Thank you. respected musicians. So the common ground among all of you, is it, or is there a common ground? Is it period practice performance? Is it improvisation? Is it both of those? I mean, because you have musicians that have a pretty wide range of what they're good at and what they skill at.
Yes. I would say that the most common ground among us is that we have all multiple fields of interest. That means, for instance, my guitarist and dancer is called Stephen Player. His background is from the street theatre, and he's very much a performer. He's an excellent guitarist, but a fantastic dancer, but not what you would expect from a Baroque dancer. And Thomas Guthrie is an English singer who's doing fantastic work as an opera director. He's working a lot for the Royal Opera House in England. And so he's sort of used to, he knows some tricks on how to move, or he would be fantastic for just to see a whole choreography almost. And then you have Helge Nordbakken, a percussionist, who his background is jazz drumming, but he's dug into the sort of more world music and African drums and developed his own style very much. And I think that's the key. I mean, my viola player, Per Bure, he's a countertenor and a DJ, and he has his own little opera company. And I think it's people being curious about many things and have skills in many fields. And then, of course, I've had interest for folk music and improvisation for many years. I've always sort of felt a bit stuck in when I have to stick to the written sheet music, which is why I, in the first place, started with the Baroque world, because it's a bit more open than the mainstream classical. But in this project, I can combine sort of all of the things. So we do play on period instruments, most of us, yes. And we are not folk musicians or jazz musicians, but it's more like, I would say, classically trained, or properly trained musicians who want to break some boundaries and are not afraid of stepping out of the comfort zone. We all like to sing, even if it doesn't always sound very good, but it's sort of part of the whole thing.
Right, exactly, yeah. I think that comes through on the recording, but also the performances, as you guys can move rather fluently between these styles and genres and stuff, that comes out. It's not like you're a group of classical musicians trying to do something else. You guys can move pretty seamlessly between these styles, and that really comes out, I believe.
When I was a little boy, oh, so my mama told me.
Once again, from the CD The Alehouse Sessions on the Rubicon Classics label, my guest Bjarte Eike and his Baroque Solistine performed two sea shanties, Haul Away Joe, don't tug too hard while you listen, and after all that hard work, Pass Around the Grog.
Kiss the girls. My lips would all go moldy. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Away, haul away, the good ship now is rolling. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Charlie, he was England's king before the revolution. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. But then he got his head cut off, it spoiled his constitution. Away, haul away, haul away, we'll haul for better weather, Jimmy. Haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
Come on, boy.
Haul away, we'll haul away together, Jimmy.
Thank you.
Puritan. He stopped a spear a-pouring.
Jimmy, way all the way.
Grog me, boys, and never mind the storm. Drink the good old liquor down, and then we'll ask for more.
For 'tis he who will not merry, merry be, shall never taste of joy. Sing, sing, the cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
Come on. Here's a toast to his majesty, and long may he reign. He's the king of the Spanish seas, and the pride of the Spanish main.
For 'tis he who will not merry, merry be, shall never taste of joy. Sing, sing, the cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
Never drunk shall he be called who's fallen to the floor, only to rise up again and boldly ask for more.
For 'tis he who will not merry, merry be, shall never taste of joy. Sing, sing, the cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
There's one thing I'll ask of you before we call for more.
Oh, who's that? Go on.
Bring to me the girl I love and the key to the cellar door.
For 'tis he who will not merry, merry be, shall never taste of joy. Sing, sing, the cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
Sing, boys.
Sing, sing, the cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
I love it too, you know.
The time period where this concept you had originated from or was, what we would call here, it was a perfect storm for this to happen politically. So take us back to England in the mid-17th century, how this came about, and which eventually led this whole political upheaval and led to what you call really the first public concert, which is what this documents. So,
well, it started with the civil wars and when Oliver Cromwell took power in England and they beheaded Charles I. And Oliver Cromwell, who then started his Commonwealth, he was a pietist. He didn't care for music very much, and there was no money anyway to keep running the concert halls or the royal theatres. So he closed down all the theatres, he closed down every venue, one could say, and all these royal musicians or actors, they were now unemployed. So some of them, of course, went to war. There's a famous English composer called William Laws, yep, who died in Chester. And some of them went to teach a bit for the nobility, but most of them were just roaming the streets of London and had no place to go. So they went where all the other people were, and that was in the public houses, in the alehouses and taverns and inns, which already then were very popular meeting points for the English if you look at, I think it's in 1632 or something, there's about 30,000 alehouses in England and Wales. It was a very, very important place for them to meet, to have political debates. And there was, of course, a lot of singing and dancing, and but mostly, traditionally, it would have been maybe some drinking songs, maybe a few catches, and singing around, maybe a fiddler playing some balladry, maybe there was a few songs like that. But now, all of a sudden, all these, in quotation marks, proper musicians started coming into these places and joining in sessions. That had two effects on it. I mean, first one was that it became much more popular to go and see this, because now all of a sudden there were many more musicians. But also the quality of the music making went up. And some of these taverns were turned into music houses. So they had maybe a back room that they turned into a little theater, or they had small places that they used to maybe just meet and debate political stuff, and they started putting up concerts there. And I think around 1670 something, now Cromwell was dead and Charles II was back in. He was a music lover, and he wanted very much to have music, but he couldn't. Well, all the money was gone in the civil wars, and he was still fighting to keep the Whigs and Tories civil.
Right.
So even if he wanted to have the 24 fiddlers, the same like the Louis had in France, but he couldn't afford it really. So the sort of freelance musician life continued. But now the music had become very popular in London. So then you see all these Italians coming there, and eventually Handel, and all this, the story of London as the music city around the turn of the century.
Right.
When we go into the 1700s. But these alehouse sessions had then become so popular, so they continued very much. And people then later, like Henry Purcell and others, Finger and Blow, and they liked to attend these concerts, present new works, maybe join in some of the sessions. So you have this sort of, what one could say, like a hybrid between a bit rougher, maybe folk-style music and composed music. And like one of these tracks that we play on the recording, which is called Hole in the Wall, which is a hornpipe from one of Henry Purcell's theatrical pieces. I think it's Amphitron, or it might be something else, Bonduca. I can't remember just now. But that the Hole in the Wall is a perfect example. It's composed by Henry Purcell, and today it's known as a session tune in Ireland. It's very much part of the whole Celtic style. And there is a recording which I can't remember, what they called, a Fairport Convention.
Yeah.
They made a recording of it.
Wow.
In the 70s, I think. And, you know, modern folk musicians think that is this is just a part of their session repertoire, but it's really a composition. So composed music became folk music became composed music. So it's this sort of in between the genres that I am very attracted to.
Well, just to draw those connections, actually the Hole in the Wall comes from Abdelazar by Purcell.
Abdelazar, yeah.
But that's the same piece, set of music, incidental music, where Benjamin Britten drew his tune for the Young Person's Guide for the Orchestra, which everybody knows because Britten made it famous. So there you have that connection going both ways, you know,
yes.
The folk connection to the classical connection.
Yes, that's exactly.
This is Hole in the Wall, thought by so many over the centuries to be a traditional English folk song, but actually coming from the pen of the great English Baroque composer, Henry Purcell, from the music he composed for Abdelazar, performed here by Baroque Solistine, led by violinist and founder, and my guest today, Bjarte Eike. Thank you. just to tie up some historical ties here. So when these people would have these ale houses, and they became known as music houses. So there were concerts, how they were advertised, whether they were advertised, how people knew about it without an internet and social media. But were they in danger, as far as your research shows, that because music was banned or, you know, heavily suppressed by the Puritans?
There was a period, I think, from 57 to 60, where there was a new decree posted by Oliver Cromwell, where he said that he prohibited music making in the public houses as well, and that anybody who would be caught fiddling or singing or doing anything with music or trying to impose their music on somebody would be arrested. So then people just started to sing more. So then you have the whole catch club boom. So, I mean, Henry Purcell, he wrote about 100 catches or something.
Yeah.
And they come from a very rough tradition. I mean, Shakespeare in Twelfth Night, he writes something about, I think it's Malvolio who comes in and he's shocked by these guys, the three people singing. And are you turning My Lady Olivia's house into an alehouse with your horrible catch singing?
Right.
And then they're supposed to sing a catch. But that also became refined. I think it has to do with those 3 years that it was prohibited, because of course people wanted to have music, so they just sung instead. And there are wonderful documents about people walking with their instruments hidden under their cloaks to not be found by the police. And, you know, so I don't think after Charles II, I don't know personally anyway, that these concerts were endangered anymore. I think in 1673, there is an advertisement in the London Gazette, which is the big newspaper, about a public concert happening in, I think, Black Horse pub, tavern, somewhere in London. And there are scholars or historians who believe that this might be the first public concert which would be open to anyone, in the whole Western world. I mean, it's 50 years before you see the coffee houses in Leipzig. And so I think it's fascinating. It has a lot of layers. It's so both historically and also musically, I think.
It's very unique. Musically, as you say, to go back to this time. Of course, this has always happened. I mean, when everything is suppressed, one thinks in our country of the 1920s, when we have prohibition, there was no alcohol. You had the speakeasies, which served alcohol, but also there was music going on there, and there was jazz being brewed there. And weird, it happens, to, just a little side note, my oldest son attends school in Boston, and he ran a house where the basement was a music venue. It wasn't supposed to be.
Amazing.
So he had 150 concerts a year in his basement. It's the same thing.
Well,
yeah,
it's fantastic,
yeah. And you mentioned Bach. One thinks of Bach going to, you know, Zimmerman's Cafe. You focus on the London alehouses. Was this, did this pop up in other countries, or just it wasn't politically necessary? Do you find examples of this type of thing happening around Europe at that time?
Well, at least a bit later, you find in Scandinavia, especially in the two cities, Stockholm and Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And I like to use a bit of Scandinavian repertoire as well, because it fits. I'm not sure about Germany. The only thing I know about Germany is the coffee houses.
Yeah, Zimmerman. Yeah.
And the coffee houses were a bit more proper. And there was also the whole thing with coffee was because you didn't get so drunk from it, of course. So it soon became the upper class preferred drink. And these events at the Zimmermann's coffee house with the music, what are they called? So, Collegium Musicum. They were not really for the whole public. I think they were really for the bourgeois people.
Right, and the academics to come and, and sort of stretch their wings. And they may have got drunk, but boy, drinking coffee all night, those things must have gone till so caffeine-laced.
Yeah.
My guests Bjarte Eike and Baroque Solistin have recorded two previous CDs on the Swedish BIS label. From London Calling, Handel and his contemporaries, we'll hear the short Sinfonia to Act 3 from Handel's Amadigi di Gaula, or Amadis from Gaul. Then from their CD and project titled The Image of Melancholy, a tune from 17th century Scottish fiddler Neil Gow and his lament on the death of his second wife. talk about the music a bit just here, because this music ranges in your alehouse sessions from, like you've already said, folk tunes from not only England but other parts, a good deal of what we'd call sailor songs, you know, sea songs, to Purcell. So you said that if you guys would just play and play and play, you'd be playing for 5 hours with all the repertoire. So you have this huge body of repertoire. How do you filter it to know what works, what doesn't, gets tossed out? I mean, how did you come about assembling this?
Well, we make our own arrangements of things. I mean, a lot of the music from that time is found in small collections, for instance, like the English Dancing Master, published first time in 1651, which became very popular, John Playford. It's a collection of dance tunes, but they're only melodies, and they only have one title and a number. They don't have any harmonies, and a lot of them are quite simple. So I think that was my first thing, because when I wanted to do this project the first time, it was part of a festival in Norway, and the theme for the year was London, and we did all sorts of things. We did some Dowland projects, and I think we ended with the Dublin Messiah, and we had an opening concert with the Italians in London around 1700, Corelli and all this, the whole high Baroque influence in London. Then, of course, obviously, I needed to do a pub concert. And then I remember I had this collection that I had for a few years of these, the English Dancing Master in a modern edition. And maybe I should look at it. And I found some melodies. They're quite nice. And I went to Frederick, who's my guitar player, and we just jammed a little bit on them. And started to put maybe two or three in a row and create sets of it, similar to the slides you find in Ireland or Scotland. Yeah, so it became a nice little project, and we mixed in some Purcell. But it was quite obvious that more folky stuff was fun to play and more popular with the audience. So I sort of continued with these collections. And then what we then do is I bring maybe a tune or a melody or a song, and we start working on it. First we find some harmonies, then we have different types of exercises. The exercise in, for instance, improvisation. So we make some rules, sitting in a circle, and then maybe every third person plays one round, and then it moves around, and then you can hear the different constellations. Sure. You can hear, oh, and then this is good, that was good. And we all have dancing lessons with Steve, so that we sort of get to know the movement, the rhythm of stuff, and we use some of the dance. We have singing lessons with Tom, so we all sing, and we have percussion lessons with Helge, so we all sort of find patterns, and we combine then all of these, and then somebody says, I have an idea, and we try them out. And so it's a very collective thing, as a sort of male bonding thing. And then you sort of, after a while, you create some favorites. And then, of course, we're trying to keep the arrangements quite open, so that when we get on stage, people will try out things. And it's a fantastic thing, because if you make a mistake, there is always somebody there to pick you up or make fun of you on stage. It's a very healthy environment to be in, except for all the alcohol drinking.
Right. Except for the setting over you.
Yes.
That's part of the art of improvisation, even like with a jazz musician or something. You have to try things out to see how they work. And you can tell it in the recording, even though, you know, this isn't a live video of this, but how you have to sort of move that line of improvisation. Because you're bringing music that's nearly 400 years old to a 21st century audience. And I'm thinking of the aria, the Purcell aria, Lead Me, where at the very end, we move into the 21st century, or at least modern times, you know?
Yeah.
And that had to be like a line you guys say, okay, we're going to cross this here and see what happens. And so, fascinating.
The most important thing for me is the authenticity in the true sense of the word, which means that it's an honest thing, and it's very serious from us. It's something that we really want to do. But it's also important to maybe say that I had to do a lot of back and forth and trying out many different things to create a recording, which I find gives this project justice, if you want, because it's a very lively show. And you won't see Steve dance, so you won't see all the interaction going on when you have a CD, obviously, or a recording. But then I thought, well, we have created some quite original arrangements of it, of some of these tunes, and they are beautiful tunes. So it's a very deliberate recording, that it's more like a soundtrack to the film, if you like.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Back to the Alehouse Sessions, music from public houses of 17th century England, and more music from Henry Purcell. The aria Lead Me from his Music to Bonduca, mixed with an Italian rant from John Playford's The English Dancing Master, all performed by Baroque Solistin, led by their founder and violinist and my guest, Bjarte Eike. lastly, I know you're completely focused on Alehouse Sessions, but this is not the first project you've taken on. You did Picturing Purcell, speaking of Purcell's music, Image of Melancholy. You did The Early Joke. So, I mean, are there things brewing in your head of projects past Alehouse that you're looking at and saying,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of things cooking. I want to focus on the Alehouse now. Sure. It's also because, no, I mean, not for the radio, but for me mentally now, because it's so much still developing. I mean, we had 2 days off on our German tour now last week, and we stayed in Stuttgart, mm-hmm. and we worked in, I don't know, maybe half an hour of extra repertory. So we keep developing it. I like to see this more as a band and not a project.
Right.
So if you're inviting a band, then you know sort of roughly what you will get, but you also expect to get some new stuff and some new repertory and be surprised. But then you're also happy to see some of the old stuff.
It's well-researched. You guys are all incredible musicians. It's very interesting, but more importantly, it's a lot of fun.
And really, yes.
That's the main thing. It really is. It's bringing bringing this music that, like I said, you may have many people in the audience who are not people interested in Baroque music. And, you know, it's 400-year-old music, and they're going to be laughing and having a good time to it. So that's wonderful.
Thanks.
I wish you the best with that. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says that if you could chat with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to but could, when I ask that question, what's the first name that pops in your head of somebody you really love to speak with or chat with?
Well, that would be Purcell,
I
think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Because for me, he's so full of surprises, and he's so rough and then so refined at the same time. He has everything. He's like the Shakespeare of music, I think.
Yeah, well, what he did with the English language is amazing. And we don't have some of those dark corners of him. He didn't live long enough to develop some of the dark corners, but still we don't have I'd like a little more meat on the bone with that. The final question is non-musical, which means everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy with all this you got going on. But when you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, need to step away from your tours and your concerts, what do you do that can sort of...
Well, I have a very loving wife and a son. I try to spend all my time when I'm not touring with them. I like to hike in the mountains. I'm a true nature lover. And I'm a very keen cook.
Ah.
I cook a lot.
Does the band get to taste your cooking?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And they're all connoisseurs, so I have to step up every time. But it's good. No, I love cooking. It's a fantastic mental... What's it called?
Release.
It's a release.
Yeah, sure it is.
Well, so anything that can release. So mountains, cooking, and maybe some Bikram yoga.
There you go.
That's me.
Well, as you bring the Alehouse Sessions to the U.S., have a great tour. And
thank you.
Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Violinist Bjarte Eike, member and founder of the Norwegian group Baroque Solistin, their new project Alehouse Sessions, music as heard in 17th century English public houses, will be coming to Princeton next week on Thursday, October 5th for two performances, the first at 6 p.m. in Richardson Auditorium on the campus of Princeton University, and then at 9:30 p.m. at the new Lewis Arts Complex at the university. Now, the 6 p.m. program is sold out, but you can contact them about the possibility of attending on a wait list the night of the concert, whereas there are still tickets for that late 9:30 program. Check out all availability at PrincetonUniversityConcerts.org or 609-258-9220. Check out more about my guest and his group at their website, Baroque Solistin, BarokkSolistene.com. And their recording, the Alehouse Sessions, is on the new British label called Rubicon Classics. Check it out at RubiconClassics.com. I'll leave you with the parting track from that CD, Leave Her, Johnny, as performed by Baroque Solistin, led by violinist and their director, founder, and my guest today, Bjarte Eike. And I'll leave you as well. But as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to WWFM.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.
For us to leave her. Leave her, Johnny, leave her. Oh, leave her, Johnny, leave her. For the voyage is done and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to leave her.
I thought I heard an old man say,
leave her, Johnny.
You must go ashore and draw your pay,
and it's time for us to leave her. Leave her, Johnny, leave her. Oh, leave her, Johnny, leave her. For the voyage is done and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to leave.
Strong.
Leave her, Johnny, leave her.
But now once more we'll sing our song,
and it's time for us to leave her. Leave her, Johnny, leave her. Oh, leave her, Johnny, leave her. For the voyage is done and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to leave her.
We'll sing, old maid, we'll never be.
Leave her, Johnny, leave her.
On a hungry ship, the likes of she,
and it's time for us to leave her. Leave her, Johnny, leave her. Oh, leave her, Johnny, leave her. For the voyage is done and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to leave her. Leave her.